This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. To many of us, Chinatown is an exotic destination, a place where you'll find cheap dumplings and unlicensed DVDs in narrow streets. The neighborhood is often portrayed as dark and dangerous, an attitude famously captured in Hollywood films. But there's more to Chinatown than many of us realize. What's Chinatown like to the people who walk through it every day? Author Bonnie Tsui spoke with residents of five Chinatown neighborhoods for her new book. We'll ask her what she discovered, and we want to hear from you. Tell us your Chinatown experiences. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. And joining us now from a studio in San Francisco, Bonnie Tsui. She is author of the book American Chinatown, A People's History of Five Neighborhoods, and a frequent contributor to the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lynn.
So for many of us, as I just said, Chinatown is a tourist destination. But like many Chinese, you grew up with a really strong connection to a Chinatown, in this case in New York. So what does Chinatown mean to you?
You know, I think my story is a pretty common one in Chinese America. My parents came through New York's Chinatown, and I was born in Flushing, Queens, which many of our listeners will know is home to New York's biggest Chinese population now. But I never grew up in Chinatown. I grew up at its fringes. I mostly grew up on Long Island, but Chinatown was where my family went on weekends for special events, wedding banquets, christenings, shopping. And it was a place where we went really to be Chinese.
And is your perception of Chinatown different from your parents, would you say?
Definitely. And particularly with my grandparents, who landed there in 1960 and lived in the neighborhood and worked in the neighborhood for 20, 30 years, I see it as a place of memory. Among my strongest sense memories is of walking around at knee level as a child, and you see all the crowds of people and the sort of mysterious puddles that you're trying to avoid as a kid, and there was a fascination there too, and it was where we went to, where we heard Cantonese spoken. My family is Cantonese, and for the better part of its 150-year history in this country, Chinatowns are Cantonese-speaking, and of course that's changing. But to my grandparents, when I interviewed them for this book, they said they feel grateful to the neighborhood as a place that was there for them, spoke their language, offered them jobs, a place to live when they first came to this country. And to this day, they don't speak English, and they're grateful for having a place that was there for them, but at the same time, they're happy to have left because in its very basic level, it's a place of poverty.
Yes. You know, one thing that runs through the stories of most of the Chinatowns that you write about, with the exception, I think, of Las Vegas, which we'll get to later, which I think is a case unto itself, but you wrote about San Francisco, Los Angeles, Hawaii, and New York. And in each of these cases, I think you say that these Chinatowns were a safe haven for the immigrants who first arrived in those states, in those areas, and still plays that role for new immigrants in this country.
That's right. Particularly in New York, San Francisco, and L.A., which are the longtime ports of entry for Chinese to this country. And the amazing thing is they still remain so, even, you know, this far into the history of Chinese in America and today, that those three cities and their surrounding suburbs are still the first places where many Chinese to this country who immigrate here will come through because of the kinship networks. And of course, there is that you mentioned that it was safe haven. It was safe haven from racism in the inception of the neighborhood and through much of its history, for sure.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, you begin the book in San Francisco, which is where Chinese immigration really began. Is that right?
That's right. It was the Chinese called San Francisco the first, you know, in Chinese, the first port, the first first place that people came through, and that was after 1848 and the gold rush years, and they came in large numbers from southern China, and they all came through San Francisco, and they all came through here and set up shop in all of the different mining communities around California, but really came through San Francisco first of all, and it has that historic gravity, I think.
And it did not become what it is today, which is sort of a tourist destination, until after the Great Earthquake, and then it was deliberately made into a kind of tourist town.
Yeah, it was. And a lot of people don't realize that, and I certainly didn't realize it when I came here for the first time when I walked through San Francisco Chinatown. I really was curious about the architecture. It seems so distinctively from the old country, kind of Disney-fied, flourishing you see on the tops of the buildings and everywhere throughout Chinatown. And when I began to look into its history, I ended up profiling the historian and architect Phil Choi, who grew up in San Francisco's Chinatown, and he taught me a lot about how the look of Chinatown was really a self-defensive measure against the racism that was very strong and potent after, particularly after the 1906 earthquake, when the authorities, the San Francisco authorities, saw it as a chance to rid our city of the Chinatown element. And you have to remember that back at that time, the Chinese community was seen as a dirty, disease-ridden place. And I think it was the Oakland Inquirer that ran this headline 5 days after the quake. They said, "Let us have no more Chinatowns in our cities." And this was what people at the time, the Chinese people at the time, were up against. And so the Chinese-American merchants at the time, they really tried very quickly to regroup from that and hired white architects to build this, what we know today as this Oriental city, this very tourist-friendly location. And they knew even then that putting on a good face for the white outsiders as a pleasant place to visit, some place that was exotic, some place that was friendly to you, would help their image in America. And that has informed the way this Chinatown developed.
And did this idea of Chinatown as a tourist destination spread to the other Chinatowns, or did they just...
It did. And actually, even though the look of the Chinatown wasn't really established until after the earthquake, prior to the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, Chinatown was a tourist destination. People were very intrigued by it. They saw it as... mostly because of the mysterious elements, the crime, the opium dens, the prostitution, and a lot of tours went on behind the scenes, not just in San Francisco's Chinatown, but in New York as well. If you look in the literature, you'll see these accounts, these tour books, these guidebooks that you could follow into Chinatown, and a lot of people actually engineered these fake tours, and with fake muggings or fake, a show, basically an entertainment for the tourists who came.
We're talking with Bonnie Choi about her book, American Chinatown, and we're taking calls. We're going to go to Pavel, who is calling from Laramie, Wyoming. Hi, Pavel.
Hi. My story happened about 23 years ago, both out of cultural curiosity, let's say, and because of a low cost. I chose to stay. I had a federal meeting in Oakland, and I was staying two nights in San Francisco, and I stayed in this very sparse, very simple and clean hotel in Chinatown. And just up the street where I was, the street turned into a switchbacking sidewalk because the hill was so steep. And I got up gratefully and thankfully around sunrise and went out in the fog, and as I climbed walked up this switchbacking sidewalk, here were off on several little patios, probably somewhere between 8 to 12 Chinese elders, men and women, slowly. I had no idea what they were doing, but there was this movement and kind of like dance and kind of like exercise. They were doing Tai Chi. And it was just, you couldn't see the field of view. You could only see like maybe 20 feet ahead at the most. And that experience has stayed with me all these years. It's just some of the most profound and delightfully alien experiences I've ever had on our continent. I'm grateful for that, and that immersion that I had accidentally in.
All right. Thanks for your call, Pavel. Interesting. I actually have seen that myself in San Francisco.
The Tai Chi in the morning.
The Tai Chi in the morning. Yeah, I've seen it in China as well. So that is pretty common, Bonnie, huh?
It is, and I've also seen it in Chinatown and in China, and it is a, I suppose you can look at this practice as something that has crossed the oceans, of course, from China to Chinatown and also the rest of the U.S. But it's a common thing to find in the mornings in Chinatown, and it's particularly in the parks where, of course, in Chinatown, it's a very densely packed community in many cities, and the outdoor spaces are very important. The parks in particular, here in Portsmouth Square, it's known as Chinatown's living room, and in New York's Chinatown, it's Columbus Park that is very much carries on these the same role.
But it's very American, the Chinatown. It's not. I have the sense from what you said that it's what you've written that it not much of it really is directly from China, other than the authenticity of the people themselves. Like a lot of
you
it
mean
is,
in San Francisco's Chinatown?
And in the other Chinatowns as well. A lot of it is sort of manufactured here, made to look Chinese, but it has to be identified as Chinese American. It's a combination
right.
of the two.
Yeah, and particularly if you're talking about the architecture of San Francisco's Chinatown, it is a very much a Chinese American invention. It was in the most literal way. You know, it was created in this laboratory of Chinese America at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century.
All right, we are talking with Bonnie Choi about her book, American Chinatown. Tell us your Chinatown experiences. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. And, of course, our email address is talk@npr.org. And we'll be continuing the conversation after a short break. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, and we have an email challenge for you. A bit later, we're going to talk about why your GPS is evil. If you have a GPS system in your car, tell us about a time it sent you off course. Email those stories now. The address is talk@npr.org, and we'll read some of those later this hour. Right now, we're talking with Bonnie Choi. She visited five of the most storied Chinatowns in the country for her new book, American Chinatown. You can read a bit about what makes each Chinatown unique in an excerpt at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation and tell us your Chinatown experiences. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org. We're going to take a call now from Rachel in Manchester, New Jersey. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good.
I just wanted to let you know that my father was a doctor in Chinatown for a few years, and he needed to communicate with his patients, so he ended up teaching himself Mandarin Chinese. It took him way longer than the years that he worked there. It took him 12 years to learn. But people think he's Chinese now on the phone, and he's actually a very typical Jewish doctor. And in order to learn Chinese, he placed an ad in the Chinese newspaper in Chinatown, New York, and saying that he would give them room at our house in New Jersey rent-free if they would teach him Chinese. So we had a couple of tenants living at our house for a number of years, and every morning they would wake up and he would get Chinese lessons for them, and in exchange they would stay at our house rent-free and sometimes cook us really good Chinese meals.
So. That sounds like a pretty good exchange to me.
Yeah. And actually it's funny, though, because the prologue to that was that he was also working in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and he did the same sort of setup to learn Spanish. So he's actually done it a number of times, and as you can tell, his hobby is languages.
Oh, that's great. Did you pick up any Mandarin, Rachel?
Not really. It's been very difficult. Yeah, I was a kid, but sometimes, you know, I would take there's one story where I took a book he was reading in Chinese, and I sort of copied the characters onto a piece of paper because I'm an artist, so I kind of just threw it. And I said, see, Dad, learning Chinese is that hard, you know.
Well, thanks very much for your call, Rachel.
No problem. Thank you.
And I think, Bonnie, that's one of the things you make clear in your book is that the Chinatown was where a lot of young Chinese Americans went to learn Chinese.
That's right. And Rachel's story is wonderful because it really taps into a very emotional center of Chinese American culture, which is this wrestling over language. And Chinese schools you can bring up to many generations of Chinese Americans and they'll have this reaction, which is, oh, it was horrible. It was, you know, we were stuck after school, after regular school, they would go to Chinese school to learn Chinese. And it was a way that the motherland kind of saw to keep the language. And that started in the early 1900s. China kind of had a mandate in the U.S. to open up these Chinese schools in all of these centers, urban centers, including New York, where they had a large population. And so countless generations of Chinese Americans have been faced with this quandary. How do we keep the language and how do we keep our kids connected to the culture? And of course, when you're a kid, it's not very fun to have to go to school again in the afternoons or on the weekends. And a lot of people ended up rejecting that as they grew older, stopped doing it. And then, of course, when you're an adult, it's a different perspective. You kind of wish that you had that. But today in New York's Chinatown, there is a new kind of Chinese school, and that's down in Chinatown, it's called Shangwen, and it means double language. And so they're more savvy, I think, with the teaching of the language. It used to be that the Chinese schools were very much about rote memorization, and this particular school is a bilingual school, and it's a public school that a lot of parents actually from around the city want to enroll their kids in, and not just
because
Chinese.
So many people want to learn Chinese now, but it's
that's
it's,
right.
It's a tough language to learn, I think. Let's take another call from Murali in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Murali.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I wanted to share a slightly different perspective on Chinatown. I am originally from India. And in India, we have Chinese communities that are integrated into the society to a degree that they just look Chinese, but they don't speak any of those dialects. They speak whatever is the native language in the particular state they're in. And my experience of it began when I went to one of these restaurants that were Chinese restaurants in India, which are, now I know, neither Chinese food nor Indian food, but a combination of curry-infused whatever, whether it's Szechuan fried rice or anything else.
Right.
And the curious thing about that is that even in the U.S. now you find these restaurants like in Los Angeles and other places where on the menu you'll find Chinese-looking names. And if you were true Chinese, you would probably be outraged at what you ate.
Right.
And that's true. Isn't that true of restaurants in many Chinatowns or many Chinese restaurants in this country that it's not really the food you'd find in China, right? Bonnie?
That's right. Yes, it is. And a lot of people who would come from China, they wouldn't recognize these dishes that we have on the menu in Chinatowns. And the story that our caller just told us reminded me of a chef, a celebrity chef that I profile in the book from Honolulu's Chinatown. And his name is Glenn Chu, and he is this James Beard Award winner, and he runs this restaurant called Indigo, and it is a Eurasian fusion restaurant. And he grew up in Honolulu in Manoa Valley, and he was raised in large part by his Chinese grandmother, who would, you know, kill chickens in the backyard and basically taught him a lot of her heritage. And he learned a lot about cooking from her. And so his food is not, he was very careful to stress to me that his food is not her food. His food is not Chinese food. He has as many influences in addition to her, including Alice Waters and, you know, French classical techniques. And he's trained in these techniques and these cuisines. But he says that the soul of his cooking is really Chinese and comes from her. and these Taoist principles that she instilled in him, which is, you know, use the entire animal. You know, you go to the Oahu Market in Chinatown, and every day you see the pig delivery. This guy comes and delivers the entire pigs to the store, and that no waste principle still persists.
I'm going to read an email also about food and eating in Chinatown from Marie in Arcata, California. I grew up in Pasadena. From time to time, my great aunt Winnie, who had lived much of her life in China, came through to visit when she was on a speaking tour. My parents and my aunties and I went with Aunt Winnie to dinner in Old Chinatown in Los Angeles each time. We went to a special restaurant there that she knew, where they took us upstairs to a private room and she ordered everything in Chinese. The things that came were wonderful. I have never seen them before or since. We never knew what we were eating, but it was truly fantastic. So perhaps there were hidden restaurants in Chinatown that most of us don't know about, but where you could get really authentic Chinese food. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true. And basically, it probably comes down to the chefs just having a back room where, you know, the family meals in any restaurant, not just Chinese restaurants, the family meals that the restaurant staff have before the dinner service is typically something more of a home cooking and not what's on the menu. And you'll find that everywhere. But I think that's certainly true for many Chinese restaurants, not just in Chinatown, but outside as well.
Let's go to Charlie in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi. Are we not? Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Are we not maybe overlooking the, how shall I put it, pink jade water buffalo statue sitting in the middle of our conversation? And what I'm getting at is those hundreds of thousands of Chinese that came over in your book in the 1840s, what else did they do? They helped build the interstate railroad system of America alongside my relatives, the Dirty Irish, years ago. And they helped civilize this country and commercialize it long before Eisenhower's interstate highway system.
Well, I have to say, in Bonnie's behalf, we probably will not be touching on everything that is in her book, but I think that she goes a great deal into, in fact, the history of Chinese in this country in her book. And
okay. Can I give my experience?
Sure.
When I was about 14, living in Chicago, growing up in Chicago, me and my twin brother, my mom and her boyfriend used to take us to Chinatown about once every 2 months, and we would go specifically to learn the different foods and enjoy the food. But we got to learn to eat with chopsticks very perfectly. And when the great Chairman Nixon okayed us to have relations with China in about 1987. I had the pleasure of going down to Chinatown on the very first day it was okay to talk to China and hear Studs Terkel and some Chinese dignitaries toast our new relation with China and America.
That's great. Thank you so much for your call, Charlie. That's an interesting
Thank
story.
You.
The story that, that Charlie just told us about the Nixon approving the opening up China again to the United States.
Right.
I don't know, Bonnie, to what degree you got into that, but how did that affect the Chinese-American community? Do you know?
Well, it certainly introduced an openness, or rather a new element into Chinatowns in the U.S. Of course, up until that point, many of the immigrants to the Chinatowns in the U.S. were fleeing the communist takeover of China, including my own family. And so people in Chinatown up until that point and still now have long memories of very serious hardships in leaving the country and leaving China, going to Hong Kong for indeterminate periods of time, kind of waiting to hear from perhaps relatives who were in the U.S. who could help bring them over. And there was no work, you know, at that time, and it was very difficult. And so I think people who fought their way out of China at that time, when it was very difficult to get to the U.S., have had a very negative feeling towards this opening up towards communist China, because they felt that the real seat of China was in Taiwan, when the nationalists fled there and established that government there. And so I think when more mainland Chinese started coming over to the Chinatowns here in the U.S., there was a culture clash. It was very interesting. You have different classes of Chinese, different, you know, educated from different parts of China, speaking different languages, and versus the Cantonese old guard who had been here for a long time. It's a very interesting phenomenon to have observed, which was that these Chinatowns were then are not homogeneous and actually are very diverse.
Bonnie Tsui is the author of American Chinatown, A People's History of Five Neighborhoods. If you'd like to join our conversation or tell us a story about your own experiences in Chinatown, give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Ty in Fresno, California. Hi, Ty.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. In Fresno, California, we have somewhat of a small Chinatown that's had a long history here, namely with the underground passages and the opium dens, that type of prohibition area. But now, unfortunately, from what I've seen, it's sort of slipping into more of a ghost town. I was wondering if your guests knew of any other cities that have experienced their Chinatown somewhat slipping into that type of ghost town-esque era, but experience resurgence and maybe how they accomplished that.
You know, that's a really good question. I'm not entirely sure of the answer to that, but what I do know is that there are a lot of communities like the ones that you mentioned, and we can go back to the Gold Rush era to address that, which is that all these communities sprouted up all over California, and they could all be called Chinatowns because the Chinese were there building the railroad, doing a lot of agricultural work, and that history, unfortunately, has sort of faded away and been forgotten in many places because once the jobs dried up, they would move to the cities. And once the jobs dried up and they still felt a lot of racism locally, especially in the smaller communities, they went to the bigger cities, San Francisco, New York, L.A., as we mentioned, to find the security, the jobs, a place to live. And they were forced back to the big cities. I think by 1920, you know, 60% of the Chinese were in these urban centers.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Ty.
Thank you.
I think one very interesting part of your book is and we just quickly go into this, the story of the Chinatown in Las Vegas, because like so much of Las Vegas, it's a manufactured Chinatown.
That's right. And actually, I mean, I'm so glad you brought it up because Las Vegas was so interesting to me to research and write about because it hasn't really been talked about. And the idea of this retail space, this man-made Chinatown being authentic is kind of jarring. And one funny anecdote about the Chinese Chinatown is that it is now a huge draw for tourists from China who come to Las Vegas. There are these tour buses that bring them to the Las Vegas Strip where all the casinos are, and then they stop in Chinatown Plaza to take pictures under the Chinatown Arch. And these are the two top destinations for Chinese tourists to the city. And I asked one woman one day how they knew it was Chinatown, and she told me, it says so on the arch, Zhongguoxing, Chinatown. The sign tells you, of course it is. But we can talk also about the founding of this Chinatown. About 15 years ago, a Taiwanese businessman named James Chen founded Chinatown Plaza, which is the mall that anchors the Chinatown as we know it today in Vegas. And he came to this country through Los Angeles Chinatown in the 70s. And he came from Taiwan and he was, in school and he could not find a job in LA's Chinatown as a busboy because he didn't speak Cantonese. And he spoke Taiwanese and he spoke Mandarin. And again, this addresses the issue that we talked about earlier, which is the culture clash between the different populations of Chinese that were coming in to Chinatown and to the U.S. Over the last 30, 40 years in particular, really started to shift. And he found his way. He learned some Cantonese. He got a job. He then started coming to Vegas more frequently. and thought, okay, every city, every major city in the U.S. has a Chinatown, why not Vegas? And since Vegas, everything is man-made anyway, I can just build my own. And he did. And
that is, that we're going to have to leave it right there. In order to find out the rest of that story, you're going to have to go to Bonnie's book, American Chinatown, A People's History of Five Neighborhoods. Bonnie Choi, it has been a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Coming up, victims of GPS, wrong turns, and dead ends. Tell us how you've been betrayed by your GPS device. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.